This is Audible. Penguin Presents The Old Man and the Sand Eel by Will Millard. Read by Will Millard. Dedication. For the great man who once taught me to fish. The Greater Sand Eel. What do they know of fishing who know only one fish and one way to fish for him? Jack Hargreaves, Fishing for a Year, 1951. I depressed the playback button on my phone for the fifth time in 5 minutes. It's killing me to keep watching, but I'm desperate to find something, anything positive amid this total horror show of a film. That is one of the biggest sand eels I've ever seen in my life, it begins. I'm shouting, partly out of excitement, and partly because the wind is whipping up so hard around the Dorset coast that it's distorting the sound on the video. In one hand, I'm trying shakily to film with my mobile phone, while in the other, I'm struggling to hold a British record fish. I don't know what else to say. It's a whopper, I eventually stammer, sniffing back a runny nose and punching the stop button. I gently place my phone on my table and smash a cushion directly into my face. I've just made the biggest mistake of my entire fishing career, and worse still, I know I've only got myself to blame. There are few sensations in life that can match the angler's almost immeasurable sense of loss when a big fish slips from their grasp. It is a poker-hot pain that continues to burn as bright in the memory as it did in the moment itself. Losing the sand eel record set me on a redemptive pathway that spanned the length and breadth of Britain. For over a year of my life, I allowed the eel to completely take over. And, in the end, my angling would never be quite the same again. But that was all still yet to come. For now, I was stuck in an angling purgatory, with bent hooks, broken dreams, and that video for company. I pressed the playback button once more. When I was a boy, I used to revel in going around my grandparents' home, a small bungalow that for me meant warm milky tea, chocolate sauce on ice cream, well-worn furniture, and John Wilson's fishing encyclopedia. My granddad would take the heavy, hardback book in his thick fingers, and when I asked him, rest it on his enormous belly and thumb through the various sections. As far as I was concerned, John Wilson was a god. He had a long-running series called Go Fishing that used to crop up for a few weeks a year on Anglia television. It was on pretty late at night, so I'd either try and stay up to watch it or get Mum to record it on VHS by laboriously punching the long code printed in the Radio Times into our tape player. Go Fishing spanned a period of time as a child when I was only ever allowed to catch tiny red-finned roach from the creek directly outside our house, roughly the ages of 4 to 12, or Argos Introduction to Fishing Kit through to Kingfisher Course Supreme Kit, if you prefer. The titles always began with John Wilson's silhouette walking on an animated but minuscule planet Earth. He lumbered over the surface of our world as a giant, striding with remarkable ease from continent to continent, passing signs that simply read fish and more fish. Pretty remarkable in itself for an adoring young superfan from an insular village in the Cambridgeshire Fens. But the best bit about Go Fishing is that despite what you might infer from the titles, Wilson rarely left Britain. His world was a chalk-fed River Wensum in Norfolk, the royalty stretch of the River Avon, expansive gravel pits, beautiful Irish lochs, and picture, postcard, perfect fish. Go Fishing's gift was that it made catching fish, often of a specimen size, seem attainable. By catching well from his own backyard, Wilson made me, a novice angler, believe I too could catch well from mine. Wilson placed equal value on all species of fish, a sort of Martin Luther King of the fishing world. So it was to be expected that in John Wilson's fishing encyclopedia, no one species, method, bait or habitat was overrepresented. From A to Z, as much page space was dedicated to boilie baits as bread, carp as catapults, wire traces as wobbling dead baits. This was important because, to juvenile eyes, it presented the world of fishing not as a game to be completed, but but has a near infinite set of variables where it was possible to utterly lose yourself in the discovery and mystery of the sport. Anything was plausible because nothing was predictable. In the go fishing era, any catch I deemed to be highly unusual was hastily reported to Grandad with perhaps the same level of enthusiasm as an ecologist might have on discovering a new species after decades of fruitless toil. It mattered not that the fish species were, in reality, just slightly less than common. The days I caught my first zander, rough and bleak, were moments to be celebrated from the highest platforms possible, from the narrow section available to me from within my grandparents' bungalow, climaxing with the highly ritualized inspection of the John Wilson Encyclopedia. The reason for this was threefold. First of all, the book allowed me to glean the definitive facts on the new species from the highest authority in the land, John Wilson. Secondly, it made me feel one step closer to my idol, also John Wilson. And finally, it was a cast iron guarantee that I could get the full and unadulterated attention of my granddad, a living, breathing, angling demigod of sorts. I inherited the Wilson Encyclopedia when my granddad passed away 2 years ago. For a few weeks, I couldn't even bring myself to open it. It smelt of him and his bungalow, a precious bridge back into those memories before the body and mind of this once strong man gave way to life and death in a nursing home. It just didn't feel right to read it without his permission and his bookstand stomach to open it from. It sat on my shelf untouched, the magic spilling from its pages. Then the sand eel slithered into my life and changed everything. I'd never caught a sand eel before, let alone one with the greater species definition. I strongly suspected it would be featured in the encyclopedia. Pretty much all the common species in the British Isles had made some sort of billing. So, with curiosity eventually getting the better of me, I decided this would be the appropriate time to finally peel open the pages of the formerly forbidden tome. I found my fish, wedged between the obscure Corbin sand eel and the squid-eating scad. With a supporting image resembling the scabbard of a dagger, the greater sand eel entry read, "The largest of the sand eel. The body is long, thin and smooth, with a greeny-bluish back, blending down the sides into lower flanks and a belly of silvery white." Wilson goes on to say that you can only catch them on exceptionally small feathers armed with tiny hooks. That's funny, I thought to myself. I had mine on the vulgarly named flying condom, a long, hefty lure, only really designed for the gaping mouth of the large sea bass or a sea-sprung salmon. The hooks on that lure are massive, thumbnail-sized and thick. Strange I managed to land that sand eel then, I supposed. For a moment, I just let that thought rest on top of my brain. A few more precious seconds of blissful ignorance after what had, up until that point, been a very enjoyable weekend. Inevitably, though, the thought drifted its way into the centre of my skull, fired up the synapses responsible for reason thought, and caused the horrifying implications of the Wilson-suggested hook size versus the ones I had used versus the size of the fish I'd managed to land to dawn on me with force. I recoiled from the book. What if the reason I landed that fish was that it was, in the modest world of the sand eel, an absolute monster? The greater sand eel description had taken me onto a second page. I knew the layout of this book as well as if I'd written it myself. At the start of each species section, Wilson always details the British record weight, which meant, just one page previously, the auspicious number was lying in wait for me. I felt a tremble, somewhere deep within my bowels. "Just close the book, Will. Close the book, put it back on the shelf, and never open it again." I turned the page back. 8.5 ounces. It was staring me right in the face in black and white, directly below the drawing of the distinctly smug-looking greater sand eel. 8.5 ounces? That's a pot of Marmite, a tin of beans, a four-pack of Mars bars, surely not a new British fish record. I didn't need to review the footage I shot that morning to know with certainty that the fish I had caught was in excess of 8.5 ounces. But I did it anyway, multiple times, and there it was, as bold as brass, wriggling along the length of almost my entire forearm. A fish clearly over 10 ounces, possibly even knocking on the door of 1 pound. A cast iron miniature record breaker, and I'd quite literally thrown it away. To say I was fuming for the rest of the week would be to put it mildly. Not only did I not speak for a good few days, but I could hardly even bring myself to look at the offending fishing tackle. I'd had my scales in my bag the whole time. The coastline had been packed with people, including my girlfriend, who had patiently waited for me at the top of the rocks, and I'd even had my camera with me. Getting that sand eel officially registered with the golden trifecta of witness, weight, and photo required by the British Record Fish Committee would have taken less time than it took me to come up with my stupid little speech on that stupid bloody video. A video, I might add, which now only exists as little more than an everlasting record of my own unbelievable ignorance. Let's be honest. No one is going to be particularly rushing to break down the doors at the British Record Fish Committee to register a new shortcaught sand eel record. Nor are the editors of the National Angling Press waiting, poised over their typewriters, for the sensational scoop of my against-the-odds battle with sand eel destiny. But that is precisely the point. No one actually wants the greatest sand eel rod caught record, which means it was the perfect record for me to break. In truth, I'm still something of an amateur fisherman. Sure, I know my way around several different styles and techniques, and I've had more than my fair share of luck, but realistically, that sand eel was absolutely my best chance of making it onto the list of official record breakers, and I had completely blown it. During the golden years of the John Wilson Fishing Encyclopedia, back when I was 12 years old, I would fish only two waters. The Well Creek outside my childhood home and Popham's O, a vast drain which I would venture to once a week with my granddad. I may have gone to the local school, but this was where I truly received my education. More than just the places I caught my first fish, these twin rivers were where I learnt my watercraft and discovered the workings of the natural world, where I made my first real friends and endured the rain and cold without running home to mum. Very occasionally, they were also the settings of the purest personal triumphs I will ever experience in my life. I'd go on to catch much bigger fish from hundreds of different venues, with far greater names than Popham's O or the Creek, and yet the memories of my time on those banks remain undiminished. I ask myself now, looking back, am I truly more knowledgeable as an angler now than I was then? In my childhood, thanks to the encyclopedia, I knew every single British fish species and its record weight by heart. How could I have not realised I'd caught a new record then? The answer was obvious, and it was staring me right in the face. On the wall of my study, I'd pinned two sheets of A4 paper. One is the optimistically titled Fishing Targets, and the other is a list of potential venues and tactics. The list includes king carp, crucian carp, eel, perch, pike, salmon and roach, with ample space for notes. Many years ago, the plan was to work my way through the entire list, breaking my lowly personal bests and introducing myself to as many new species and varied environments as I possibly could, just as John Wilson did, and, it pains me to say it, just as my granddad would have liked. I look up at that list now and know I've badly let him down. The pages next to all the native species are barren, whereas the sections dealing with my introduced and very foreign king carp are absolutely crammed with information. Monument, linear, redmire, popped up plastic corn, 4G squid, the source, crab mist, chod, braid and spod. The list goes on and on. Years of accumulated information on a single species from a single type of venue that has completely suffocated my childhood knowledge of the wider piscatorial world, pushing king carp facts into one ear and everything else I've ever learnt about fish and fishing right out of the other. That lost greater sand eel was a sign from above. I'd stopped caring about where I fished as long as there were fish. For two decades straight, the places I fished were near identical commercial ponds and lakes, filled to bursting point with artificially reared carp and brought to my net using much the same methods and baits. As a result, I failed to identify the record breaker in my hands and rightfully lost my chance. Now, with the rediscovery of the encyclopedia, I have all the ancient wisdom I could possibly require on virtually every single species and fishing technique within the British Isles. And that sand eel which slipped between my fingers is the kick up the arse I fully deserved and desperately needed. I prize the list off the wall. It's been up there for a while. The blue tack has gone hard and takes a small flake of paint with it. And I select the biggest, thickest black marker on my desk. Striking a meaningful cross through the entire king carp section instantly makes me feel better. It's catching, not fishing. Grandad always used to say that every time I talked up my latest carp conquest at the local commercial fishery. I'd give him the withering teenage eye roll, reserved for uncompromising adults. But it's only now I realise he was bloody right all along. I scribble all over the freshly drawn cross for good measure and focus in on all of the other names on the list, taking delight in rolling my tongue over the names like I'm reading a fairy tale to a child. These are legendary fish, steeped in history, yet bullied to the periphery of most anglers' imaginations by this nationwide king carp obsession. To find the native, truly wild populations of these fish, I'm going to have to travel to the sorts of places that exist well beyond the public gaze. Spots where most wouldn't even think to cast a line. Tangled underworlds, crumbling docks and urban rivers, the dwellings of the truly abandoned, where a unique kind of freedom survives, distinct from the regentrified, reimagined and sanitized versions of wilderness that I've just wasted the last 20 years fishing in. I spread a map of Britain out on the table and am immediately struck by just how well watered this nation really is. The rivers and lakes stretch right across this island like a giant central nervous system, easily dwarfing our roads and motorways through their sheer scale and abundance. Obviously, not all these waterways will hold record breakers, and I wouldn't get very far attempting to wet a line in every body of water in Britain, but I know there are definitely ways of shortening the odds in my favour before I set off. A quick search on the internet finds me the British Record Fish Committee's Record Coarse Fish Register, which helpfully includes all the places the fish were caught and by whom. That feels as good a place as any to start out, but I know I must avoid being completely hamstrung by someone else's list. A lot of these venues will have seen serious angling pressure since they produced their record, and doubtless some of them will also be part of expensive and exclusive clubs that I just won't be able to access. But records are there to be broken, and fish die or move on elsewhere. If I'm going to give this a proper crack, I need to look to offshoots of pre-established record-breaking waters, speak to local people, and be prepared to take seriously the near-mythic stories of park lake monsters and river beasts. After all, just sticking to the beaten track was pretty much what got me into this mess in the first place. I take a deep breath. It feels like I'm learning how to fish all over again. I know this is going to take patience and extraordinary amounts of luck, but the night before I attempt the first fish is utterly sleepless. I feel like I can actually sense the monsters of my imagination queuing up to be caught, pressing against the inside of my eyelids, willing me on to success. The Striped Assassin. Proper fishermen would never set up their rods before seeing the water they intend to fish, but I'm not a proper fisherman, and have learnt the hard way that I make a much more proficient job of putting together my tackle in the dry confines of my kitchen than on the bankside. By the time I've made it out the door and down to the river, lake or pond, I'm usually far too excited about the prospect of the first cast to concentrate on tying my knots properly, and thus set myself inexorably on the path to experiencing the devastating parting of fish from angler, right at the point of least resistance, my crap knots. The line peels from the real silver barrel with a series of soft clicks and glides over the wooden top of my chair. I plan to keep this setup extremely straightforward, as big perch hate complication. I squeeze an extra large shot of weight, the shape and dimension of a rabbit dropping, but heavy and hard, on one end of a short 6-inch length of line. That'll keep my bait pinned hard to the lake bottom. To the other end I attach a swivel, a tiny barrel of metal with two small rings at either end, which I then thread onto my main line. The swivel allows the weight to slide sweetly along the length of line without registering any resistance, should a big perch pick up my bait. It slides down sweetly, free and smooth, right along the length of the line till it hits the rod's tip with a satisfying plink. Perfect. Zero resistance. The perch won't even know it's hooked. My whole life has been one spent surrounded by water, and my happiness can be accurately measured by my proximity to it. I was born in the Cambridgeshire Fens, one of two, 5 minutes before my twin sister Anna, with a little brother Tom, coming along some 7 years later. Ours was a house filled with nature, thanks in no small part to the unbridled enthusiasm of our dad. He was a magical figure to me as a scabby-kneed under five. I didn't really understand why he was so often not around. The demands of his job as the local village doctor, frequently taking him away from us for longer than we would all have liked. But when he was there, he poured his love of wildlife deep into the souls of his children. Through him, I learnt to seek pleasure in bird-watching walks and fenland waterscapes, or to train my eye onto the very tiniest of life forms, dissecting the underside of a carefully lifted log with forensic precision, in the hope of snaring one of the worms or pungent ground beetles that lived there. He seemingly hadn't inherited his father's passion for angling, but in those early days he armed me with the essential patience and respect I would require to winkle out fish later in life. My earliest memories are really just a haphazard collection of senses and emotions, but they all revolve around the natural world brought to my palms by Dad. First there was Norman, the Airedale Terrier, unwisely purchased just before Mum gave birth to us twins. He was a mix of hyperactive ginger, hardwire wool and smelly wet tongue. Next was the mustiness of Dad's vast butterfly collection, which had a sort of pungent, slightly oppressive perfume-like smell that you might also find around the embalmed corpses in the British Museum. I've always associated that scent with the dark wood and glass that contained his treasures, and, if allowed, I would open the drawers with real care and reverence. The residents of these cases were frozen in time, ossified and rigid, captured and sacrificed all in the name of science. Even if I removed the glass they were trapped behind, they could never glow or float through the sky again. I knew that this was not a time to smile or make jokes, as the creatures that lived in there were actually just dead. Living animals in the house, apart from Norman and the occasional woodlouse that made it very briefly into the room I shared with Anna, were accommodated in the circular conservatory at the back of our home. This pleasure dome for captive wildlife all but guaranteed victory for the Millard twins on the Upwell County Primary School show-and-tell table. Something that was of extreme importance to me at that time. Plus, it was perfectly placed at the foot of the garden, providing a thrilling portal between the familial and the feral. Dad would often hatch foreign moths and butterflies in the warmth of the glasshouse. The death's head hawk moths were easily my favourites, with their human skull patterns emblazoned on their thoraxes like bikers' tattoos. I thought they had to be just about the coolest insect that ever lived. But it was in the careful handling of the giant atlas moths that I learnt the value of being gentle with any living creatures. Even the smallest brush of a wingtip could leave a guilty trace of their dust on my fingers. It was the atlas depositing tiny scales from their bodies and would dull their colour instantly. Even today, despite having pulled a fish through the water with a hook in its mouth, I chastise myself at the loss of a single scale as a result of any rough handling on the bank. Dad taught me that it was sometimes okay to catch animals to study and admire, but as he aged, his focus became less on capture and more on the observation. Photos replaced traps, his butterfly collection waned, and the insect population of the conservatory began to dwindle. I guess that was where Dad and I differed in our approach to nature. For him, it was enough to simply observe and understand from afar. For me, it was necessary to get as close as possible and, ideally, hold the creature in my hands. It wasn't a case of wanting mastery over the natural world. I wasn't one of those cruel kids who would pick the legs off a daddy long legs for a laugh. I just seemed to get infinitely more from something I could actually hold, touch, and years later, catch, then release. One day, a new resident was installed in the conservatory fish tank. It was to be my first close encounter with a fish. And my goodness, what a fish it was. In researching for this book, I've since learnt from Dad that the brook lamprey was actually with us for only a single night, caught in a willow wicker work trap by an eel catcher from our local creek and given to Dad because he was into that sort of thing. Yet I remember it like it was there for the entirety of my early childhood. For the under fives, time lengthens and memories compress in unusual ways. That one night stand with the lamprey made a massive impression. According to the Wilson Encyclopedia, the brook lamprey rarely exceeds an adult length of 10 inches, which is quite extraordinary, as I was fairly convinced our specimen was the size and girth of a Burmese python. Wilson goes on to note that its sucker-like mouth is used only for adhering to the undersides of stones. Now, not that I wish to accuse a fisherman, of all people, of understating the facts somewhat, but at no point does Wilson highlight that this fish has to be one of the most bizarre-looking creatures in Britain, if not the planet Earth. Not only does it have no fewer than 7 separate gills running in a hole-punch-like line right down its body, but he also neglects to mention that its sucker-like mouth is in fact a horrific circular suction pad filled with a truly nightmarish series of studded teeth. For hours, my sister and I stared at the curious fish in the tank, utterly transfixed. It didn't seem to move much, preferring instead to spend its time stuck hard to the glass side of the fish tank. Perfect for me, though, as it afforded a close-up view of those extraordinary mouthparts for the brief period it was in our custody. It was a highly unusual capture anyway. The brook lamprey is most often found in fast-running streams where it can happily breed on gravel deposits. In the turgid, murky waters of the river outside my home, it seemed an absolute imposter. That thought delighted me. Out there, beneath a brown theatre curtain of surface water, was a sub-aquine wonderland just waiting to be discovered. A place where real monsters lived and died, well away from the gaze of us land-dwelling, air-breathing mortals. Yet, it could be accessed briefly, if, and only if, you learnt how. Dad took its picture, and the next day the lamprey was gone, returned to live out its unlikely and doubtless quite lonely life in the water running around our tiny village. And I was left to advance an obsession with what else might be caught from water. In the ironed-out landscape of the Fens, water is absolutely everywhere, and, as a result, I grew up an extremely happy little boy. I needed guidance to access water for the first time, of course, but Mum and Dad were never afraid to let me go near the water's edge, with supervision initially and later on my own. I was lucky. Lucky to have so much space to play in safely, but also lucky to have parents that understood the importance of allowing me to discover the outdoors and water for myself, by myself. I'm at that stage of life now where all my friends are starting to have children of their own. It only takes moments in the company of a young person to realise that a fear of water is inherited and not innate. Last week, my 2-year-old niece, Edie, was utterly mesmerised by my fish tank, desperate to dip a net in and learn the names of the fish, her wild eyes reflected in the glass sides as her mind hungrily consumed every new scale pattern and plastic leaf. Eventually, she reached out her tiny hand and ran it along the tank corner and on into the wet within, learning in that moment the curious interplay between glass and water. It's fascinating to see, and I believe a vitally important part of development. Yet most children these days are absolutely forbidden from taking any interest in water outside of the bathtub. How many times have you seen anxious parents grasping the hands of their children in horror as they approach the 6 inches of deep water at the edge of the municipal park pond? Or adolescents getting terribly scolded for daring to place their fingers in a perfectly clean town centre stream? Eventually, these irrationalities rub off, and those children grow up with their own unnatural fear of wild water, and somewhat inevitably, so do their offspring in turn. Not all of those fears are completely without foundation. Tragically, the last decade has seen an average of 390 people per year drown in accidents in British inland waters. But look a little closer into the figures, and you'll see that that doesn't automatically mean that the water outside our home is inherently dangerous for young children. Of those 390, the single largest category is males aged between their mid-teens and mid-twenties. Many instances are alcohol-related, most are avoidable. Young people, looking to prove themselves by swimming distances beyond their ability, or fatal injuries caused by diving headfirst into surprisingly shallow water, or water that is dangerously fast, or too deep, or just shockingly cold. Instead of teaching young people to be aware of the risks and guiding them towards safer areas to play and wild swim from an early age, the prevailing attitude seems to favour putting up warning signs, locking gates, building barriers, and telling our children that natural water should not be entered under any circumstances, and especially not for your entertainment. Let's face it. Since when have any of those sorts of measures stopped your average young person hell-bent on besting his or her peers? Year on year, more obstacles to accessing our water appear, and year on year, the number of deaths stays more or less the same. Surely, it is better to invest in teaching our children how to manage risk in water, and thereby avoid tragedy, than to let them stay indoors where they live their lives vicariously through the internet and television. There are reams and reams of studies proving the physical and mental health benefits of just being near water. More than that, though, perhaps most importantly, in fact, our fresh water desperately needs our attention. Thanks to myopic human development, rampant pollution and climate change, freshwater habitats are now easily the most endangered environments on Earth. In the last half century, the doubling of freshwater withdrawals for our own ends has caused 50% of wetlands to vanish altogether, and fewer than 70 of the planet's 177 longest rivers remain free of man-made commercial obstructions. For freshwater fish, the news is even worse. One third of all species are threatened with extinction today, compared to 21% of mammals and 12% of birds. Yet if you cast a speculative eye on the adverts of all of the major wildlife charities, you'd be forgiven for thinking our fishy friends are doing just fine. But if you are beginning to think it's bad for them, you should check how awfully the amphibians and freshwater invertebrates are faring. You may well like to believe it is in the developing world, in the sorts of places where populations are dependent on harvesting freshwater fish just to survive, that the results would be at their worst. But looking at Europe in isolation, we see that the number of fish species facing extinction is nudging up to a shameful 40%. And, according to the European Environment Agency, half of our rivers and lakes are polluted. Things aren't much better in the United States either. Over the pond, the rate of fish extinction is now over 800 times faster than in the fossil record. We are marching to the brink of a worldwide environmental disaster, and yet there is little more than a whimper of protest. Of course we should all be up in arms, but how can you reasonably expect people to care about saving an environment that they are preconditioned to believe is irrelevant and dirty at best, or a dangerous menace at worst? Every garden should have a pond. Ours was oval-shaped and about 10 feet wide. At one end, there was a neat little shallow area that allowed amphibians to come and go as they pleased and provided a safe nursery area for frogs and toads to spawn. It dropped to a depth of no more than a couple of feet from that shallow point and was stepped in at the edges so Mum and Dad could submerge baskets filled with aquatic plants and water lilies. In the summer, the centre was near solid with Canadian pondweed, an invasive species that shrouded the pond's surface with its green, pipe-cleaner-like tendrils while providing oxygen as well as shelters of the host of invertebrates that lived within its bulk. It was here I learnt how to hunt frogs, the first living thing I ever knowingly caught from water. The first living thing I caught unknowingly from water was a miller's thumb, a 3-inch long microfish with a fat head and rounded tail that slipped inside my wellies when I fell into a stream in Yorkshire. I was appalling at first. My hand-pink hands slapped the water surface like a drummer's cymbal each time a frog dared to lift its head above the weed. The first rule I learned then was to be patient and observe. Soon enough, I realised the frogs in the centre of the pond were never to be caught. They always had a couple of feet of water below them to sink down into, whereas I was aiming at only about half an inch of a frog's head. To go for them in the middle was to disturb the whole pond for hours. The best bet was to wait for them to approach the edge, as the shallower water would significantly narrow the frog's options for escape. At first I would leap up and try to grab them the moment they came within reach, thus breaking the second rule. Keep your profile off the horizon. Down the frogs would plop en masse. It took me some time to realise that if I stood up, particularly with the sun behind me, the frogs would see my silhouette 10 times out of 10 and scarper before I could get anything like close enough to catch one. So I took to lying on the grass, obscuring myself with the pond's bordering plants and watching like a tiny blonde otter. It was to be the beginning of a lifelong fixation with peering into water. As a child, I couldn't really make out the difference between a natural or a man-made habitat. But that hardly mattered, as nor could the wildlife. I remember being amazed to discover that if you left rainwater to puddle in a bucket, it would quickly become inhabited all by itself. Usually, this just meant a colony of tiny water beetles or millions of species of swirling zooplankton. But sometimes I'd find mosquito larvae jerking in the water like a tiny hairy finger trapped in a door, and in bigger, older water traps, like the defunct water butts or abandoned cattle troughs that got left around farms, it was possible to find small fish, thick black leeches, and, very occasionally, even an eel. Not all ponds are the same, but the best times to observe, and afterwards to fish, were early mornings and later in the afternoon. In most ponds at such times, a background hum of life builds in a crescendo like an orchestra tuning up before the performance begins. This was when our pond was at its most magical. Bright damsels and acrobatic dragonflies, the assassins of the sky, hunted on the wing above my head as fearsome diving beetles plundered the unfortunate larva living below. I had a soft spot for the alien-faced water boatmen. They seemed like gentle souls who didn't need to attack anything in the pond. But the pond skaters were always the most impressive. With their fine displays of nimble skills on implausibly long legs, these thumbnail-sized insects comfortably outmaneuvered the birds and beasts that wanted to eat them by propelling themselves along the pond's meniscus at an incredible speed. Dad taught me that everything which lived in the pond relied on the health of its tiniest living organisms, and if I scooped the pond water into my hands and viewed it with my pale palms as a backdrop, I could just make out what he was talking about. Hundreds of tiny, haphazard dots made up a dense concentration of zooplankton. Water fleas, daphnia, and the water worms that held this whole environment together. Their presence was why he didn't want to stock our pond with ornamental goldfish or koi carp. Pet fish would soon eat all these miniature friends, as well as the beetle larva and the frog's tadpoles, until, eventually, the entire system in the pond would stop being able to support itself. Then we would have to buy food to feed the pet fish. Food which, I later learned, was largely made up from wild-caught baby sea fish, fish oils, and even the krill that provided the foundation of the ocean ecosystem. It all seemed a bit crazy, really, damaging one ecosystem to artificially prop up another. So we stuck with the wildlife pond. If I was really quiet, I might be able to see the garden birds, the song thrushes, blackbirds and sparrows, bathing in the shallow end of the pond. They would do this all year round, even in the middle of winter when the pond had a skin of ice and I could scarcely stand to put my hands in the water. but it seemed to happen most often towards the end of a long, hot day. They would shake themselves vigorously afterwards, puffing out their feathers and finery as if they'd been placed in front of my mum's hairdryer and toweled down. As darkness fell, the pipistrelle bats with their coats coloured like old bricks, their dark ears, faces and wings would funnel down flying insects by the thousand. I knew I would soon have to go back into the house for tea when that performance began. But not before I checked my surroundings for a repeat appearance from my most exciting discovery of all time. A small shrew that once crawled along the pond's bank and right along my side as I lay there. It sniffed the air with its comically conical nose and screwed up its tiny eyes in disgust. It knew something was up, but I don't believe it ever realised I was there or what I was before it shuffled its way back into the undergrowth. The frogs had a curious habit. They would actively hunt and, to my juvenile mind, play in the deeper water. But they tended to come to a standstill when they were submerged in the shallows right in the gaps between the planting baskets. They felt safe there, I guessed. And with that, I'd cracked my third rule. Find the sanctuaries and exploit the routine. Soon I had my first definite touch of slimy flesh. Next, I briefly clasped a leg. And then, finally, after a summer of study, I proudly held my first frog. I only had it in my hands long enough to splurt out the M of mum before it released its stripy legs from my clutches and powered its way back into the pond. But it was, in my mind, a massive accomplishment. I would tell everyone in the family several times of my heroism, establishing a lifelong fourth and final rule. Always amplify any special capture, especially if there was no witness. Finally, with no one else in the house left to tell, and my sister getting visibly irritated by my boorish antics, I made my concluding performance to my grandparents. "Impressive, son," Grandad remarked at the curtain call, lifting an inquiring white eyebrow from behind his large, wire-framed glasses. He casually dropped an absolute thunderbolt into my life. "So, what would you say to trying to catch a fish?" A spark flickered into life, somewhere well behind my out-and-proud belly button and the small of my back. A truly great journey was about to begin. I was almost 5 years old when I caught my first fish, but I can't tell you what it looked like. I was so excited by the prospect of catching and holding a real live fish that when my float eventually slid under the water, I struck so hard that I projected my catch directly out of the river, over my head, and deep into a field filled with sugar beet. "A little too hard, perhaps, Will," said Grandad, after a short spell of mutual silence. He took the rod, freshly baited the hook with a couple of maggots, and recast into the middle of the creek. Technique wasn't all that important in those seminal days. With Grandad, it was all about experiencing the first fish on the bank, by whatever means possible, and enjoying time spent in each other's company. That meant size was an irrelevance also. Our best bet, clearly, was with the vast shoals of roach that teemed within the Well Creek right opposite the house. They never seemed to grow beyond a few inches in length, but that didn't mean they were foolish. Far from it, in fact. With the float now bobbing happily in the centre of the creek once more, I was passed back the rod. It was my first, a bright red two-piece number with a smooth plastic handle and reel loaded with light monofilament line, and I loved it more than anything else I've ever owned. "I'm just going to feed a few maggots to get them interested," said Grandad, selecting a pinch of the wrigglest bait tin residents and flicking them out around the float with extraordinary accuracy. The float bobbed. "It's another bite," I screamed, standing up, blowing our cover and forgetting to strike. Grandad pulled me back into the seated position via the elasticated waistband of my bright red shorts. "You've got to stay calm, Will," he implored, in hushed tones, his eyes sparkling with suppressed laughter tears. I refocused, pleading with the float and river to give me just one more chance. A couple more maggots flew out, And then, finally, mercifully, it happened. In the photo of that first fish, I'm sat next to Grandad with a look of utter disbelief plastered across my face. My eyes are as wide as they could possibly be, gripping a length of line with what can only be described as a miracle on the end of my hook. Incredibly, given how many roach were in the creek, my trap had worked its way into the mouth of a small skimmer bream. Like the roach, the skimmer appears to be a silverfish, but is, in fact, the juvenile form of the darker and much larger common bream. It differs from the roach in its elongated slate-grey anal fin on the underside and its generally much flatter, wider appearance, hence its skimmer name, in homage to a skimming stone. To be honest, it could have been any fish of any species ever. My reaction would have been just the same. In that moment, I was the king, the master and commander of the river, the man who had unlocked the secrets of the deep and tamed the great beasts that lay within. It mattered not that this was, in reality, an extremely small specimen either. In that brief moment, I had been handed the keys to a lifetime of pleasure and study, and in Grandad, I had a more than willing teacher. The 5 years I then took to reach the age of adolescence revolved around fishing and an endless supply of fishy stories and patient tuition from Grandad. The pond, the conservatory of animals, my family, and later school, all dissolved into the background. I had a new magic man now, capable of conjuring the most almighty tricks with a dainty flick of his thick wrist. We float fished for the creek's roach at any opportunity. He couldn't say no. I was irrepressible. He would rock up to ours usually on a good sunny day, as Grandad really hated being cold, even though he did always like to claim there's no such thing as bad weather, just bad clothes choices. He'd be wearing a floppy sun hat and a t-shirt usually several times too small for his enormous stomach, and would often have a large pork pie secreted somewhere on his person, wrapped within a capacious handkerchief and brought out well away from the interfering eyes of my grandma. I had the rod and reel, of course, a couple of cheap floats and a handful of hooks and weights he had given to me himself. But he would always ask, "Got all your stuff then, Will?" as if my collection of tackle were vastly larger and not, in fact, comfortably able to fit in his top pocket. Grandad was both a thrifty man and extremely industrious. His fishing gear was as ancient as it was immaculate, and his favourite floats were all handmade from drinking straws. "McDonald's ones are the best," he often claimed, usually before adding, "It's the only time you'll see me in that bloody place." Repetition and consistency are a key component of any good angler, as well as any good grandparent. The session would begin with me taking 10 times longer than him to prepare my rudimentary tackle. I would first thread a small orange tip float onto the line by a tiny hole at one of its ends, and then secure its tip with a small rubber sleeve, a finely cut piece of tubing that fixed the float to the line. Next, I would carefully tie on a hook from Grandad and pinch a small line of lead shots, intended to cock the float till just its top half inch would show above the water. Finally, I was ready for bait. I would take an age to decide which 2 of the tens of thousands of maggots would be skewered onto my hook, usually drop a couple of 100 on the floor by accident, and then spear the grubs through the wrong end and have to start all over again. When I was eventually ready to make a cast, I would either overdo it and chuck the whole lot straight into a tree, or I would forget to release the line on the reel and tangle my float approximately 1 million times around the rod tip. Both eventualities took time to fix, and would nearly always result in me having to start the whole process again from scratch. Grandad would never fish on through my dramas, but he wouldn't just sort it out for me either. I had to learn to do things properly, and, as tackle costs money, it paid to learn quickly. Time passed, and gradually I improved. In the early days, any fish was a real bonus, but several seasons in, I was beginning to catch nearly every time we went out. Expectancy is a terrible thing in fishing. It murders the heady rawness of feeling you get from the first few fish you ever caught by suffocating it under a fixation with catching as many fish or as big a fish as you possibly can. Sadly, a bit like the first time you ever fell properly in love, or saw a magic trick, or rode on a roller coaster, that exhilarating feeling of holding one of your earliest fish can never be matched by simply catching more of the same. With the sheen fading from the silver scales of the roach, I began to wonder what other challenges might be living within the depths of the creek. One day, while quickly retrieving a redfin roach along the creek's surface, a massive impact tore my fish clean off the end of the hook. My line fell limp at the rod tip, and I turned to Grandad, near rigid with shock. "Pike, son," he said, with a solemn and knowing glance at the pathetic remains of my roach, which was now little more than a smattering of tiny silver scales descending to a murky oblivion. I had just been humbled. That was a man's fish, and I knew I wasn't ready to take it on. But luckily, there was another, more pocket-sized predator lingering close to my diminutive grasp. The temperature gauge in my van tells me it's a dispiriting 4 degrees centigrade outside. I flick the indicator to take a long right-hand turn at the roundabout by the football club and steam happily away from the commuter traffic trailing into Cardiff for work. It feels like the wrong day to begin this challenge. The Vale of Glamorgan strikes me as particularly numb and lifeless this morning, lumpen, cold and grey, like the contents of a mortician's drawer. I turn up the fan heater and squeeze the accelerator. It's overcast too, but that doesn't bother me nearly as much. Big perch hate bright conditions. To be fair, even 4 degrees centigrade isn't truly the end of the world. There's plenty of fish willing to feed in those conditions. But this is the first major temperature drop after a sustained period of double digits, which is very bad news indeed, as fish really dislike sudden changes in temperature. And, worse still, the opening frost of winter is forecast to arrive tonight. That's an event guaranteed to put every fish in Britain off its food. After a frost, some fish species will remain on the bottom, hidden, in a trance-like torpor, just subsisting off their reserves until the warmer months stir them back to life. Others, like the perch, will adjust to the colder climes after just a few days and will gradually come back on the feed. The worst possible time you can try an angle for them is just after a frost. The second worst time is right now, just as it's starting. By rights, I should have stayed under the duvet this morning, but I felt I had one very good reason for wanting it today more than most. Fishermen are among the worst offenders when it comes to believing in signs. I've seen the most hardened atheist turned clairvoyant when it comes to the desperate search for a fish-filled future. Scientific anglers who, no matter what the conditions, will only fish their lures and flies in a certain order. And those who sincerely believe that a specific choice of socks or the sudden appearance of an auspicious bird or favourite mammal can conjure a fish for the fishless. Even my granddad, a no-nonsense engineer throughout his working days, would never fish the river if there was even a hint of a westerly wind. What was sticking in my craw that morning was that it was precisely a year ago to the day that I lost the biggest perch of my life. I simply had to go fishing. A little perch is almost every little fisher's first ever fish. It wasn't quite mine, of course, but they were an ever-present pleasure in the creek, ready to step in and save my blushes when a blank day seemed otherwise inevitable. "Like a Japanese warrior in his medieval armour," intoned Jack Hargreaves in his 1951 classic book, Fishing for a Year. And what a perfect simile that is for this classy little predator. With its hard, sharpened gill plates, black eyes, and spine-tipped and sail-like dorsal fin, the perch is absolutely built for a fight. But it's a strikingly handsome fish too. Its flanks are marked by a series of immaculate black stripes, blending perfectly over a dark olive backdrop, with striking blood-red fins and a whitened cream belly that is wonderfully plump in the bigger specimens. It really is one of the best-looking of all the freshwater fish. Unsurprisingly, it was one of the most in-demand fish to pass under the taxidermist's scalpel in the Victorian era. But it's the perch's mouth that truly must strike the fear of God into any fish or bait unlucky enough to fit inside. For the perch must be the greediest fish ever to have lived. Its jutting jaw is specially hinged, allowing its oversized mouth to engulf surprisingly large prey. As a boy, I would often catch them fishing on lures intended for pike 10 times larger. Such is the perch's capacity to sense weakness and an opportunity. When they are in the mood, they will bully their patch of water and intimidate others with a yobbish enthusiasm. On the creek, we would catch them near boat moorings, reed-lined banksides, or, more often than not, directly beneath wooden jetties, right in amongst the pilings, where they can leap back and forth from their ambush point. Clearly, they're comfortable in large shoals. I remember one astonishing day with my little brother when we simply could not stop catching them. Like shelling peas, we flipped them out, one after the other, from an area under a landing stage no bigger than a ping pong table. Eventually, it got so embarrassing we had to stop and upended a keep net filled with at least 100 little stripy fish. On a clear day, I'd observed the creek's vast perch shoals, tucked tight into the holes and structures they preferred, allowing their zebra stripes and dorsals to fuse with the reeds, wood, or each other, till the individuals were near indistinguishable from the shoal. From here, they would conduct their remorseless assaults, plundering the roach fry like a marlin destroys a bait ball, sending their panicked prey scattering on the surface in great shimmering plumes of silver. On occasion, I would spot one or two that were clearly a lot larger than the rest. Humpbacked and aloof, these were the adults. These wise old fish were given respectable space by the smaller fish in the shoal, most likely not out of deference, but because big perch have a cannibal's reputation. They would observe me with an infuriating indifference as I made cast after cast in their direction, never once looking even remotely likely to come to my hook. Eventually, they would tire of my intrusion and would simply disappear with a flick of the tail, leaving a boy with a face redder than his rod, kicking up clods of turf in wretched frustration. The Wilson Encyclopedia describes a mega specimen as any perch over 3 pounds, and lists the British record at 5 pounds 9 ounces. But, as I write, the current record is now headed by two separate fish caught just a year apart, and which tip the scales at a whopping 6 pounds 3 ounces. What I wouldn't give to catch such a perch. I can't think of any other species where the gulf in skill between catching the smallest member and the largest is so vast. It has to be one of the biggest challenges available to the British angler. Once hooked, the perch is unmistakable. The pugnacious jag, jag, jagging fight as they repeatedly dive back for their cover is like having your line attached to the sword of an Olympic fencer. It singles out the striped assassin every time. In the bigger ones, this pulsing motion is only magnified till the shudders on your rod register with the force of a pile driver. As a child, having blown my opportunity to snare a big one for just about the millionth time, I consulted Grandad on the appropriate method for snaring the larger of these princely predators. The tail of a lobworm, nicked through the bloody stump, he opined simply, in much the same manner as a witch might recommend a wicked potion for curing warts. "Is that really all there is to it, Grandad?" I inquired, my heart full of hope. Grandad was a keen devotee at the Church of Lobworm. They were the only alternative bait he would consider when his maggots failed to work. He dug his mud snakes, the largest of the British earthworm species, out of the sweet-smelling compost heap he managed out the back of the bungalow. From there, he would roll them tight within long leaves of newspaper and stick them in his large white chest freezer. I recall the first time he showed me his supply. "Don't be shy about using a big hook. It'll work, but look, Will." He stopped and fixed me with his big brown eyes. "Big perch need patience. You can't be jumping about and recasting all the time. You have to learn to time it right, early mornings or the last hour of light. He placed his giant forearms on the chest freezer's top and leant forward. You must be prepared to wait for him to make the first mistake. Otherwise,